Hi, I'm Donna.
And I'm Stefan.
And together we bring you Changes Podcast, where we talk about life changes, no matter how big or small.
In each episode, we interview people from our community who have drastically changed their personal or professional life, sometimes by pure chance or other cases by absolute determination. Our guests will share their personal and professional motivations to change, challenges they have overcome, what they have achieved afterwards, and how sometimes the role of chance has played an important part in their journey.
You may wonder how and why people seemingly out of the blue just appear to change a certain life or career path. This is the show where we bring you real people with real life stories and how they overcame ever-impeding obstacles.
In today's episode, we will take you on a journey around the world with Claire Baxter. Claire is a Melbournean who has experienced many changes in her professional sporting career. She sometimes needed to make tough choices in her professional and personal life. And now she will share with us where it all started.
I was living in Melbourne, Victoria, and I was cycling competitively for quite a few years. I think about 7 or 8 years. I suppose from the time I was about 14 or 15. And the dream was always to become a professional cyclist.
Big dreams and the unwavering dedication to her sporting excellence. Claire won a combination of Australian Club National Championships, which then gave her the opportunity to ride professionally.
The first stop for me was to ride professionally in what was called a continental team with about 6 or 8 women in it in a place called Marciano in Italy, which is about 30 kilometres away from Perugia.
Claire's arrival was challenged with language barriers and other obstacles along the way.
I'm a little bit taller than you. Than your average woman, and they set me up with a bicycle that was just way too big because they took one look at me and said, oh, she's quite tall, so she won't fit a standard size frame, so we better give her a bigger one. And they did. So for the first 2 or 3 races, I was racing this bike that was the size of a truck. And so my early introduction to Italy was one of having to negotiate and having to make my needs known, and having them sort of thwarted at every turn. And they would often throw their hands up at despair in despair at me and say, she can't speak Italian.
Claire was soon to realise that sometimes change is not always what you had dreamt of, and reality may very well be a stark contrast.
The experience in Italy was one where I felt it was an adventure and it was all new, and I felt like I was really getting there. I'd become a professional cyclist. I was making a career. It was overwhelming because I went from being, you know, someone who could occasionally achieve results in Australia to someone who was not achieving any kind of result in Italy, because the fields were much bigger. There were 200 or 300 women racing, and I wasn't in the top 10. I wasn't in the top 20. I was lucky to even get in the top half of the field that finished. So part of making it and becoming a professional career was quite humbling to realise that any delusions of grandiosity I might have had about my cycling capacity were very much grounded.
Claire demonstrates her never-die attitude and keeps running towards her next dreams.
Those dreams were really shattered because I went from feeling really fit and really ready. I felt fitter than I'd ever felt before, and I seemed to be just riding the bike fast. I seemed to have a bike that fit. This is a mountain bike. This was at least the actual course was at Lister Field, and the Commonwealth Games was in Melbourne. I was handling the bike well. I knew the course. It was the kind of course that suited me. And I was so fit, I felt like I was jumping out of my skin. Only to get into the race and my bike broke, and I sort of picked up this bike, and people who I was racing against, who I know that I could have beaten easily, they were just riding past me, and I picked up my bike and I ran. And at that time there were 3 pit stops around the circuit, so I ran with my bike on my shoulder to the first pit stop where our mechanic was. And he quickly tried to fix the problem, and that took a few minutes. So by now, I was the last person in the field, like by minutes. And so I jumped back on my bike and I started riding and I began to catch up to people and the bike broke again. So I then ran to the second pit stop and the same thing happened. And I just spent the whole Commonwealth Games just pedaling. The train would derail, it would go into the spokes, I couldn't pull it out. I would try, you know, my fingers were kind of all smashed and sort of greasy and mangled and bleeding. I would pick the bike up on my shoulders and run to the next pit stop. And it was so obvious. It was all over Red Rover. People were lapping me. I was out of it. But I kept just trying. I kept picking up this bike and running to the next pit stop until eventually, you know, the race was over and I was a DNF in the games. And then after that I had a contract. So I went from riding the Commonwealth Games to a contract position in Belgium for a different cycling team. And it was, I felt quite, in some ways I guess I'd come off the back of a failure, but I just felt really out of it. I felt like I was I couldn't quite understand how to navigate the team dynamics and the politics of it. And I actually started achieving some results locally in the Belgium criteriums, but my heart wasn't in it anymore and I just didn't want to do this. The dream that I had wanted was fading and I felt a lot of dissonance at this. I kept thinking, Claire, you know, this is what you want. Your career is happening. Why do you feel like you don't want to be here and why do you feel like you'd rather be doing something else? And this was enormously distressing for me because I suppose my identity was wrapped up in being a cyclist and trying to make it on the professional scene. So it was for quite a few months. I felt a kind of agony and distress. I remember that I didn't sleep much at all. And when I was training a lot and I was performing okay in the races, but I didn't care. And there was one time I was racing and I either won it or I came second or third in a local criterium. And the team were really happy and there were sort of prizes and money and bouquets of flowers and photographs. And I remember just being there and thinking, wow, I don't care. I don't care. I wouldn't make any difference to me whether I was on the podium or, you know, somewhere in the middle of the peloton. From there, I did something really unusual that I never would have done before. A friend of mine was staying in Oxford. Her husband was doing a fellowship there, and she wrote to me and said, "Oh, Claire, we're both in Europe. Would you like to come and visit us?" And I remember thinking, "Yeah, I'll go." And then it was like, "Wow, how can I even contemplate something like a holiday? I'm here racing and training, and you know, dedication and commitment. That's my middle name." But I found myself contemplating this holiday. I couldn't stand the thought of being separated from my bicycle, so I packaged my bicycle up in a box and I sort of lugged it around on the train system all the way, and it was really, really annoying and I wished it wasn't there. And then I got to Oxford and my friend said to me, "Oh, well, can you chain it up outside, the bicycle?" And I said, "Oh, no, no, of course I can't. It's not a commuter bike. This is a racing bike. You never shackle them up or chain them to anything." And they said, "Oh," and I said, "I have to keep it inside." And they said, "Well, the only place to keep it is in the bathtub." And I didn't ride it at all. I couldn't sort of face it. But every time I went into the bathroom, this bicycle was in the bathtub, reminding me of its kind of existence. And I sort of would see it and feel tortured because I should be riding and training and stuff. And consistent with this, I'd started doing something really rebellious, which is I'd started running. Back then, if you're a cyclist, the advice was you should never run because it breaks down your legs. It's quite a different kind of motion. So I would rebelliously get up a little bit earlier than everyone else each morning, and I would run. And I was very careful about this. The first time I did it, I ran for 3 minutes. And this was sort of like some kind of statement about my lack of commitment to cycling that had started to grow ever since I was in Belgium. And so when I was in Oxford, I left the bicycle and I just ran. I ran through all the gardens and all the colleges, and also opened my mind because I met people and I started talking to them. And it wasn't conversation about sports. They were conversations of an entirely different nature. And I sat down and I was just immersed in different worlds. I mean, there were people talking about particle accelerators. There were people talking about historical events and socio-political movements. And I just loved it. I couldn't believe it. I felt like I was kind of drawn to this different world. And at the same time, I felt this enormous guilt for not being a cyclist and not wanting to cycle and not caring about it anymore. And then I remember I called home and I spoke to my partner back at home and I said, I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit cycling. And I was so surprised, but I'd said these words. And then after I'd finally said that I was going to do it, I was like, wow, I'm going to do it. And I went from the trip in Oxford. I then had to lug the bicycle that had stayed in the bathtub for the whole week back across the train system. And I went straight to the flight centre in the town and I just bought a ticket home. Then I told the manager, I just said, oh, I'm leaving.
From the top of her game and now with her dreams deflated, Claire returns home to Australia to reflect and reconsider her next move.
That was the end of a cycling career and it was quite weird because I knew that I wasn't a cyclist, but I had no idea what I was now. No idea at all. And all I really had was this idea that I quite liked running. So I would run every day and I got involved in competitive athletics and that became something I did for a while. But for a long time, I wasn't really anyone or anything. I was just someone who used to be a cyclist.
Even with the loss of her identity, Claire kept going.
I went back to Melbourne and it's always been sport for me. So I joined an athletics club. And the appeal with athletics was that it was all about me. There was no team to navigate. There was no team politics. This is in my mind. This is how I idealised running. There was also no equipment. It was basically just me, my mind, my body, and perhaps a pair of shoes. And I joined the athletics club and I started running competitively. And I very much experienced that and I loved it. I also experienced the humbling status of not being much good at it. I was a decent club runner, but that's all I was. So any dreams of running and achieving at a higher level, such as a state or national level, I was training very hard, but it came quite clear that that was perhaps beyond my capacity. So it was a humbling experience, one in which I began to understand that if you don't love the sport for what it is, if you don't love the activity for what it is, independent of the results you might get from it, then it's probably not a good place to be.
Claire was now left with a deep, burning desire for change. Although extremely grateful for her life experiences to date, she believed there was more to pursue. And again, this just might take her to a foreign land.
I felt like I'd had three really amazing experiences, but had unfinished business. And it's sort of like a kind of phoenix thing. I kind of rose from the ashes. I could never accept this idea of not doing competitive sport. And I was struck by this idea that I wanted something technical. Running and cycling, it's not that they're not technical. It's just that they're not like basketball. They're not such open skills like, I don't know, say basketball or football, where there's a lot that's unpredictable and there's a huge range of skill sets and movements that you go through. So I began to look at martial arts and I tried karate and did it for about a month, but I didn't like it. And then someone suggested to me that I try this sport called Muay Thai. And I walked into the gym. The gym was located in Brunswick in Melbourne. And as soon as I walked in there and I saw this woman kicking the pads and I saw her doing this and I just knew that was what I was going to do. It was just this instant recognition. Yes, I'm going to do this sport.
Once again, Claire, with her hard work and dedication, committed herself to be the best of the best. Claire started fighting in Melbourne and very quickly she depleted the fighting pool there and then discovered another gym up in Brisbane. Again, she outweighed her competition. Naturally, Claire's next step was to go to the origins of her new passion, which led her to a new gym in Bangkok, where she spent about a month.
Enter a foreigner, and worse, a female. Claire had all the odds against her, as Muay Thai is a big money spinner for the locals and a male-dominated sport. Again, Claire finds herself immersed in another culture with language barriers and now also a strict hierarchy and protocols to comply with.
I returned to Australia feeling quite frustrated and I felt like the sport had given up on me before I was ready to give up on the sport.
Success is when preparation meets opportunity. Claire lives by this and is always open to possibilities. No is not a part of her world and was now determined to prove them wrong. What she does next is inspiring to those of us desiring change. This time around, she discovered a blog by Sylvie Von Douglas Itu, an American journalist and Muay Thai fighter. Using her suggestions, she sent an email to a gym in Chiang Mai in the north of Thailand.
Hi, my name's Claire. I've had 15, 16 fights. Just want to know, do you take foreigners who want to fight? Do you take women who want to fight? Can you get me a match? And they wrote back and their answer was, well, if you're good enough, we can get you a fight. And I just felt this enormous relief. I'm like, yes, that's it. That's right. Like, that is the kind of, that answer said so much to me. So I think I bought, you know, I just booked in straight away. I bought a ticket and I was there. And while I was there, it was incredible. It was like the right person stepping into the right environment at the right time. I was willing. You couldn't hold me back. I was at every training session. I got there early and I left and I was the last person to leave. And I was like a sponge. I was just soaking up technique, anything that anyone could give me. And the trainers responded to that. They saw someone who wanted to learn and they saw someone who wanted to fight. And so I established these good relationships with people. And in that first month, I got two fights. And it was amazing. After all of this time struggling and trying to find fights, things were happening. And I was really quite sad at the end of the 4 or 5 weeks that I spent there because I had to return to Australia. I had commitments back in Australia that I had to return to. But I knew that I was going back to Australia to save money and return, which I did. I returned, I think, 5 or 6 months later. And I had a plan to sort of stay for an indefinite time. And I stayed and I fought again for them. And after about 2 or 3 months, they offered me sponsorship. And that was just like, yes. And so the experience of Thailand was one whereby there was this perfect fit between me, my will, what I wanted to do, and what the gym wanted to do. Because what they wanted to do was to find foreigners, and they were very pro-women because they identified women as a sort of emerging market in the professional fight scene. So they wanted to work with women who were committed and who wanted to fight, and they wanted to find those women fight. So it was a sort of perfect match. And that played out for about 3 years, in which I was a sponsored fighter, and I lived training and fighting for a good part of the year in Thailand.
Now living the life of her dreams, Claire is very focused.
The first high was, first of all, just being in Thailand. And I remember for my first fight, I remember thinking, oh, this is amazing. This is a dream come true. I'm fighting a Thai person in Thailand. And that was an incredible experience. I just loved it. I remember being in the in the area before you fight. And I just felt this incredible calm and incredible focus. It was a sort of feeling of surrendering to fate, whereby I've done everything I can do. I've learned as much as I can possibly learn. I'm as fit as I can be. And now I have no idea what's going to happen. I don't know what this opponent is going to be like. I don't know how she's going to fight. And I have no idea who's going to win or lose. And I just loved that feeling. It was just this feeling of being totally relaxed in the face of uncertainty. And I felt utterly alive. And I remember thinking, yeah, this is how my life is meant to be. And in the moments leading up to the fight, it was just like this clarity, this feeling of rightness.
But there are also some strange experiences along the way.
And this Thai man came up to me and he was staring at me. And I smiled at him and he was still staring at me. And I felt like this kind of, I was like, what is going on? And he smiled and he inched closer and then he actually put out his hand and he squeezed my muscles. And I was thinking, my goodness, what is this? And then the manager, Ood, who is Thai and she also is fluent English speaker, she moved up beside me and she said, Claire, don't get upset. He's trying to work out whether he's going to gamble on you or on your opponent. And I thought, oh, it's okay then. I'm just a gambling proposition. It's not a proposition for something else. And so all of this happened and it was just absorbed into this whole wonderful experience. And I went into the ring. The fight I remember quite well. There were a lot of times where I was not able to to make the fight the go the way I wanted to go. My corner, though, were so 100% behind me. I've never felt so supported. I've never felt like people wanted me to win as much as I was experiencing then. And I won the fight, not by knockout, but by decision. And when I look at the footage of that fight too, I'm pleased because it's a fair fight. And I think the judging was correct. And so I came out, it was not only my first fight in Thailand against a Thai person, it was also a victory. And the experiences were all different. The next fight was against this woman called Messa, who is the most extraordinary fighter I've ever come across. She moved in the ring with a kind of fluidity and an intelligence that I've never seen before. And I fought her and I lost, and I was just so pleased to have fought someone at her level. And I just wanted to fight her again. I found her afterwards and she didn't speak any English, but I bowed to her and I thanked her for the experience. And she looked at me and she smiled and she understood that I was indicating my appreciation towards her, and she bowed down back to me. And I also spoke to the manager and I said, I want to fight her again. Can I fight her again? And it so happens that we fought, I think, four times. I fought Messa. And most of the other Thai people I fought, I won. I beat. I never beat Messa. And it was four fights. And each time I felt the fight got more and more exciting because I was getting better every time I fought her. But she was getting better too, and she was getting better at reading me. So I would up the game. But she was always a couple of steps ahead of me. And it was just awesome. And my dream was, I sort of thought, I don't care if I fight her 100 times. And in between fighting Messa, I'd also had the opportunity to fight for a WMC world title, which to me was just thrilling because in the world of professional fighting, you don't get to become a world champion. But if you're lucky, and if your managers, if you've got a good enough relationship with your managers and the gym is politically astute enough and powerful enough, you may get the opportunity, and the politics is going your way, you may get the opportunity to actually fight for a world title. And this happened, and it was with a WMC belt, which is a very prestigious title. And I fought in this and I won it. And so suddenly I had some kind of credential, some kind of currency, some kind of recognition in the sport, which made it a bit easier to find fights in some ways because I was a name. And the gamblers now had gotten used to me, and perhaps they wanted to see me in fights. I was a kind of known quantity. And in Thailand, fighting is very much influenced by the demand of the gamblers. And I also ended up fighting another fighter, way above my weight class actually, and I won a second title, this time a WPMF title, at a festival in Ayutthaya by a combination of hard work, training, really strong bonds with the trainers and the gym, and just the combination of politics and good fortune. I ended up holding the two most prestigious belts in Muay Thai. So that was a WPMF and WMC belts. And I still hadn't beaten Messa. So apparently I had world titles, but there was a woman out there who had fought four times and never beaten. And I desperately wanted to fight her again. And she was probably getting a bit bored of it. You know, she'd fought me four times and beaten me four times. So I put the belt up for offer. I said, I don't care. Whatever it takes, I want to fight you. I can't remember whether I had two belts at this stage or one. Sometimes the events get a bit confused in my mind. So it was a WPMF belt and we were all geared up to fight it on one of the bigger, I think it might have been the Queen's Birthday festival. And I couldn't wait for it. I mean, it had less to do with the belt and more about the chance to fight Messa again. And I knew there was a good chance that I could have lost this belt, but I didn't care. Because it seems like my career in many ways was about chasing Messa and the opportunity to fight for her. And I was so excited about this, but unfortunately I fell sick with bronchitis, which then morphed into pneumonia. And I was trying to train and I could barely even walk, you know, into the gym, put my gloves on and hit a bag. And so I had to pull out I had to pull out of the fight, and I ended up in hospital, and I watched Messa fight someone else I still held the title, but because Messa was fighting and because she'd accepted the fight, I watched her fight someone else for what was called an interim title, and I watched it from my hospital bed. And from there, I was so sick. I flew out of Thailand, and with the idea that I would be, it was understood that I would return to fight whoever won the interim belt, which of course was Messa. And so I knew that I had to recover from pneumonia, and I had it in both lungs, so I was quite sick. And it took quite a while to recover. And I was getting ready to fight Messa, and I was coming back to Thailand with the understanding that this would be a belt fight. And then the promoter changed the date, and they changed the date of the fight, and it was about 2 weeks after the set date. And Messa just said, I can't fight that anymore, because she was a well-known fighter in Thailand, and also she was also making great strides and achieving great things in the world of professional boxing, not just Muay Thai, but professional boxing. And I think she was boxing for the army, and she said, I can't, that's close to this big event that's worth a lot of money. And I think she was representing the army, or she was fighting in that, and she said, no, I can't, I have to withdraw from the Muay Thai fight. And at that point, it was like my world fell apart. You know, I was so sad. I remember just hearing that news when the manager came out to tell me that in training, I just got the news and I couldn't train. I just picked up my backpack and I walked home. I was so sad. And the fight went ahead and I fought another fighter, but it wasn't the same. And it was this sense of waiting and waiting and waiting for this fight that didn't mean as much. And in a way, the dream was beginning to crumple at this spot, and I fought and I won again. So I then had, if you like, three titles, but it was this sense of actually wanting to leave the situation and get back to the rest of my life. So I left and I returned to the rest of my life, and I continued to have a good relationship with that gym, and there were further fights. And some of them were, you know, their own story, but there were some, including I was the first person to represent that gym in America, where I fought at Foxwoods Casino in line fight. And then after that, what happened was there were literally no more people to fight, in my experience, and weight class. And so I ended up returning this time to Melbourne with this idea that, you know, if the fight scene called, I would go. I would simply drop everything and head over to fight. And I was going to be fighting a Russian fighter for the title, and I was gearing up and preparing for that when she had to pull out with a damaged ACL ligament. And so at that point there were no fights, and it seemed that the sport was receding from me, and there wasn't much I could do about it. Even if I was to travel to Thailand, there would be no one for me to fight. So bit by bit, I suppose, I developed a new life in Melbourne, and Muay Thai became less and less part of that, because it couldn't be part of that, because there was nothing left.
And finally, Claire is going to tell us what she would say to her younger self.
I don't know whether I'd say anything to my younger self, but I certainly wouldn't live the same way that my younger self lived. Because I think the message that I feel now is, oh, for goodness sake, just stop fighting and go with the flow. Because I feel that when that magic happens, and when person and the person's drive fits the environment and the social group, that's when magic happens, and that's when things go forward, and that's when wonderful things happen. Whereas if it's just the individual's drive and they're trying to sort of coerce the environment around them, or even the others around them, to go along with that and make that happen, that's what I call sort of fighting or struggling, and nothing works then. There's no magic. There's just discordance and no coming together, no working together. And that's a waste of time. And I think what my younger self didn't realize was that she didn't need to fight Nelly so hard. I could have made things easier for my younger self if she'd realized that a lot of the time it's about sitting still and seeing where the opportunities are, and seeing where that potential is, and then just nurturing those relationships and going with the flow a bit rather than fighting so much.
We look forward to bringing you other interesting guests sharing their life experiences in future Changes podcasts.
Most importantly, we would like to acknowledge and say thank you to the wonderful Joy Radio staff who made this podcast possible, with a special mention to T. Butler.
Thanks, T.